Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good evening and welcome to
Foment About It!
I'm Rachel Jacobs.
And I'm Mary Izette, and we're your co-hosts through this weekly journey of all things fermented.
Archived right here on Heritage Radio Network and on iTunes and Stitcher and wherever you may get your podcasts.
Awesome. All right, so welcome to episode number 154. Couple of announcements. First off, tomorrow, Tuesday, March 8th, is the day that the American Homebrewers Association National Homebrew Conference, a.k.a. HomebrewCon, registration open. So it is in Baltimore this year in early June, and it has sold out in years past. So if you do want to register, I would make sure that you have a membership to AHA and then go to homebrewcon.org, I believe it's .org, and register. This Saturday in New York City is Saison Day. That's Saturday, March 12th. It's put on by Allagash at Three's Brewing Company at 333 Douglas Street. It's going to go from 2 to 6 p.m. There are going to be about 27 breweries, including Three's, that are pouring various versions of Saison. There's also going to be a homebrew competition. I am supposed to pour. We'll see. I had to do a quick Saison, so we'll see how it goes. I believe there's about 10 homebrewers pouring as well, and there will be a people's choice. So I actually participated last year. It was an awesome event, again, from 2 to 6 at Three's Brewing, 333 Douglas Street in Brooklyn.
That sounds awesome. And also tomorrow, once you're done registering for HomebrewCon, you can bring your ciders over to Wassail for their, which is going to be a new monthly cider meeting. You have to bring a cider.
And, a homemade cider.
Yes, you have to bring a homemade cider to share with others, and I'll be bringing my terrible Skittle Brew. So hope to see you there. You can register online with Wassail. Was it wassail.com? WassailNYC.com.
Yeah. Cool. All right, so we have a very special show for you today. So we're bringing back Tony Limuoco.
Hello.
And we had talked to you about kimchi before.
Yes,
that was
a
couple years ago, though.
Yeah,
And you have been making a ton of sourdough bread.
A ton.
And are embarking on a new business
as
well. All right, so we are in Tony's apartment here in Prospect Heights, Brooklyn, eating some of his delicious sourdough challah, and drinking some tasty coffee. So this is recorded a couple days ago, but it's super cool to do on-site visits, too. All right, so talk to us about how did you get into sourdough bread?
Well, this was a sort of a New Year's resolution from last year to go back to stuff that I started years ago and didn't do so well at. So I went back to baking, and I went to this whole... When I lived on Dean Street, I had the most incredible convection oven. But any kind of pastry I made out of just turned into like a hockey puck or a brick. You know, it was terrible. And then I kind of gave up on baking, which is funny because my friend John, an old classmate of mine, said he in college, there were a few of us that actually made food.
Yeah.
As opposed to getting a car wash burrito. And John said something like, hey, my birthday's coming up. Could you make me some of those crunchy cookies you used to make? And I'm thinking, crunchy? Oh, burnt peanut butter cookies. So instead, I sent him biscotti and some bread, and I embarked into bread making to really refine and look at like what is the science of it, where did I go wrong, and how do I make it better?
Cool. And what did you start with?
Really basic stuff, just really rolls. Those are the easiest things. The very enriched doughs with butter and eggs. So like Parker House rolls. Then working my way through like the higher rise yeast breads. So some of the country breads, challah, of course. The New York's famed challah, and really stepping back to go, what is sourdough?
And is that where you started with sourdough, or did you start with commercial yeast?
I had to take baby steps to find out how not to burn things, and then move on to the longer process.
That's good.
Of
I like the journey.
Buy an oven thermometer for suggestions. Yes. Don't rely on what that stove is telling you.
So when did you start? When did you take the dive into sourdough?
It's been about just a little less than a year, because soon after I started reading more about sourdough, and I got very interested in, of course, the fermentation factor. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a commercial yeast, but then here's this age-old tradition, you know, centuries-old tradition of cultivating a wild yeast and, you know, bringing it into baked goods, breads, etc. And I thought the most interesting thing was just the question of, like, when did this turn on its back? Like, when did it go out of style? Like, why is it we have commercial yeasts, and why is no one doing as many wild yeasts? You know, I mean, there are, you know, I love the walk back to, you know, to how things were traditionally made. That's always my question. It's like, well, how did we do it before we had freezers, or how did we do it before we had commercial yeast?
And how will we do it again when there's an apocalypse?
Yeah. What happens when apes rule the planet again? I will be the sourdough king. The kimchi sourdough king.
Yes. Oh, man. Your kimchi's so good, though.
No, thank you.
So when did you make your own? Did you get a starter from somebody, or did you make your own starter at the beginning?
I actually made my own, which did not take, and I had so many questions as to why. And shortly after, a friend of mine gave me the famed tartine starter from the West Coast, and it was really racing both. And it's interesting, over the course of under a year, what happened, which is the tartine starter died after 6 months, and I just couldn't resurrect it, no matter what I tried to do and all the instructions and advice I got from people. The strongest advice was, it's almost impossible to sustain a West Coast yeast on the East Coast, and I found that to be true.
If it doesn't evolve.
Yeah.
Because a lot of them will just basically take your house culture.
That's what happened.
Is it true the other way around as well?
Yeah, it is. And I'm very careful about the starter that I created, which is, it could be taken over by commercial yeast.
Right.
You know, and that's something I always, you know, I try to be as make it as scientific as possible and clean down the surface as if I've used a commercial yeast, you know, and really wash out all the mixing vessels and whatnot completely. Yeah. But the second thing I found was my starter had to mature, so it wasn't as good, and I still consider it a young starter because it's like less than a year, but at the same time, after about 6 months, as the tartine starter died, mine got stronger. And it died a few times on the way, you know. And I had some great advice from a friend who's been doing it since she was 12. She just said, you know, just let it sit and really get funky. Start over with 2 tablespoons and a half cup of, you know, fresh batter, and do that for a whole week. Just keep changing it out. And it's actually so reliable now that once I take it out of the fridge where I store it, it just kicks back up within an hour of room temperature.
Wow.
So awesome. I feel like I've done something right here.
Yes. So you keep yours in the fridge in between. So you, well, first of all, let's go back, because I know, like, I've done sourdough before, and I always use the pineapple juice method.
Yeah.
Which is, for me, is incredibly reliable. I know we had
Sarah.
Yeah, that talked about the raisin method. Raisin, you know, there's a lot of different methods to do sourdough, and you just start yours the traditional way.
Well, actually, what I started adding to it, it was a suggestion from a friend. Use raisin water.
Okay.
And potato water. And those two, like when you're done boiling your potatoes, use that, reserve that. And I think that's just an additional source of potassium and starch, you know, that flour may not have most immediate, you know, readily available.
Cool. So do you feed it with raisin water or potato water? Is that where you start, or do you feed it with that occasionally, like if you make potatoes?
Well, I consider it that I'm still evolving my own yeast.
Mm-hmm.
I occasionally feed it raisin water.
Okay.
And
how do you make it cold soak?
And you know everyone's concerned about chlorination, and I always say we're lucky in New York, our water is very good.
Yeah, sure.
I lived in Colorado, and it's like pouring chalk out of the water. Yeah, it sounds weird to go, like, I thought it was supposed to be natural and clean up here. Meanwhile, everyone has a water softener, and you have to let that evaporate before you can.
Yeah,
we're lucky in New York that we have good water.
Yeah.
work from.
I do occasionally go back to feeding it with raisin water.
Okay.
But I'd say for like every time I bake, I really just start off. I take the starter and make a levain, with that it's just bread flour and whole wheat flour. You know, so I try to keep that so I can monitor the kind of ingredients I'm using and net weights, you know, and it's still my science project. Measure the pH level.
Cool. So you're all right. That's great that you, because I know we were, when we first got here, we were looking at your scales, and I think that is important, especially if you're getting into something baking wise, to really measure your and ingredients and keep pH, track of that. It's pH like brewing. You got to keep a bread notebook.
It is. I've got my disgusting loose leaf covered in flour and cat feet notebook. The pH factor is important. I don't have a pH meter. I bought pH strips, mm-hmm. and that's fine. It was funny. I bought them for kimchi, and the problem I didn't realize was that they're supposed to indicate the color by turning red. So the whole thing's red. See?
Yeah. Right. That's true.
In this paper.
Yeah. I went like, oh, that was kind of a loser deal, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But it really works well with a starter, and I only take pH like once a month. I mean, it's like watching the stock market. You can't do it every week.
And what pH are you aiming for? I have made sourdough, and for a while I was doing it last winter, but I didn't actually use, we have a pH meter, so.
Ooh, hello. I'm going to come and knock.
We can compare notes after I start.
So what's the ideal pH for
a low pH for this is, it's only what I've been reading, is 3.8 to 4.2. So it's the level of kimchi.
Okay.
You know, actually, it's the level of most fermentation, which is the pH that's most comfortable for lactobacillus. And that's one of the major components of sourdough is the bacteria creates an environment that the yeast can survive, live, and populate in. So that pH factor is, you know, I always say at some point, like, you know, my friend Sherry's been doing this since she was 12. She never measures anything. She just says, you know, just add a little. You know, it's like talking to someone's Italian grandmother. Like, what? I need spoons. I need weights.
Yeah.
But she says when it tastes at the when it tastes a little bit like a lemon, you're ready.
Wow.
So that's kind of a nice way to think of it, since a lot of us don't have like schmancy equipment.
Oh, yeah, you should taste your starter before you put it in.
I do, and it's kind of gross, but yeah, I do. Yeah. I go like, sour. That's sour. Yeah, it's done.
And you said you keep yours in the fridge in between. Yeah. How often do you feed it?
I feed it once a week.
Okay.
You know, and I've been advised otherwise. You know, my friend Sherry is my big advocate and bread guru, and she says she feeds hers once a month, but she usually keeps it out on the counter since she bakes almost daily.
Oh, okay.
And that would be ideal, and that is the next step, which is, you know, as I'm starting this business, is now I have the opportunity to keep it at room temperature at all times, since I'll be making larger batches.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, according to what my friend says, that is what ages it and creates more character and assumes more culture and bacteria that's sustainable.
Because it's exposed more to what's in the environment.
Anyway. Yeah. You know, if they're like, we're in New York, is it like ground tires and pigeons? Or am I getting linden yeast from outside of the tree? I did do this funny thing. When I went to the park and walked around with an open jar.
Nice.
That's what I was told to do. Like, you know,
You can collect yeast. I mean,
you walk around with a big jar. And I did that, and I think that helped. You know, I made sure to try to walk by some of the cherry trees during the
Yeah.
Like, I'm the crazy guy walking around with my hand in the air under a tree.
You're like, what are you doing, sir? Like,
nothing!
It's public property.
Yeah, exactly.
So tell us about some of these breads that you made today.
Oh, well, you just had the the sourdough challah, and they say this is the way challah was traditionally made. So, it, you know...
People didn't have grocery stores and, you know, little packets of Instant Yeast back in the day.
Yeah, they had this, you know, they had a starter and they kept it going. You know, I'm not one of those... I'm not from a people where they say, my grandmother brought this over on, you know, from France. I could tell you something like, well, my parents brought this can of Spam from Guam, and I hang on to it for dear life. It's an antique. You know?
It's probably still good.
It's probably still... Yeah. It's probably going to last, outgrow me, you know, yeah. Outlive me. But with the sourdough, I mean, what I enjoy about it is it's a longer fermentation, unlike the commercial yeasts made with, you know, any of the baker's yeast. Those are monocultures that are, you know, selected and bred to put out within hours, you know, and whereas sourdough, for me, has been an average of 18 hours of from start, making a levain, to refrigerated fermentation. That's a total of around 18 hours. And what I do like is that it's an unbelievable flavor. It's just tart enough. There's just more character. The texture is incredible. Mm-hmm. And that's what I found the big difference was racing the two different types of baking, commercial yeast versus sourdough, is like my challah bread with regular baker's yeast, it's okay. It's nothing to write home about, you know. But this, I go, I would pay money for that.
Yeah.
Challah bread without the sourdough is, I mean, without the sourdough culture is a lot denser and a lot, like, heavier, and this just feels very airy.
Yeah, it's I think, you know, according to all the stuff I've read, and Michael Pollan, it really changes the chemistry of the starch and the protein in a way that whereas commercial yeast do not. And that's due to the way the bacteria synthesizes and makes available a lot of the nutrients that you don't get out of regular yeast. Regular yeast adds CO2.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's I'm not knocking it. We all love our good thin crust pizza. Yeah. You know, whereas if you try it out of sourdough, it's always too goopy, you know?
Yeah. Have you tried making a sourdough pizza?
Yeah, it's goopy. You know, I was like, well, it's, round is overrated. I like this amoeba-shaped pizza. It's all right. It's all right.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what the shape is. So we talk about, for those people who maybe haven't made bread as much, what is a levain? And how do you make it?
Okay. Well, in sourdough making, and some commercial yeasts of baking, it's two steps. You have your starter, and that is what I've been cultivating for about a year now. You make a levain, which is the wet, doughy, risen yeast. And that is what's, as the French word implies, it's something that raises, lifts, and adds air. And those are the first two steps. So
and that's kind of like, if you're a homebrewer, it's kind of like making a starter.
Oh, yeah.
Like you're building Absolutely. Up your yeast, or in this case, yeast and bacteria mix, enough to tackle a bread loaf.
Yeah. And the levain is also a security way. I mean, it's a way to guarantee that, as we all do with testing, that your yeast is still viable.
Right. Oh, yeah.
So that way you don't go right into it and go, all I got was this rock.
I bought commercial yeasts and found that they were dead.
Yeah, that's happened to me too. I just make the assumption that it's okay, and then you go like, what happened to you? I put all my faith in you, yeast.
Yeah. And on that note, we're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back, and we'll get right into making your actual loaf.
All right.
Cheers. The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com. All right, we're back on Foment About It with Tony Limwaka. We're talking sourdough.
And sourdough starters.
So we've been talking about a levain. So that's just, you said, just like a sponge or a... Yeah. They also call a... Is that also called
a sponge? It's called a sponge. Okay. You know, the American word is sponge. We like to simplify things because we can't pronounce levain.
Yes, that's true. Tricky. So once you get this, you said that, do you leave that on the counter? Do you put that in the fridge?
That's room temperature. It's not on the counter. You know, whereas the starter, I store it in the fridge because I don't bake every day yet.
Yeah.
But I can store that refrigerated for feeding it once a week. I could store that for months. And I found so far that's been good. The levain is the raised sponge that you use to actually create the bread. So that is a separate, a separate fermentation. Again, as we talked about, it ensures that your yeast is still viable, so that way you don't wait 18 hours later and ask yourself, what went wrong? Yeah. What happened to you?
So how do you know when your levain's ready?
Well, let's take a look at these two here. It should be very active and bubbly. And it's a misunderstanding as to what people are talking about. Let me just drag this right over.
Cool.
I started this.
This is the benefit of on-site visits.
There we go. Now, this is more another thing that Italians use called biga, which is a fermented dough. Except this is a fresher version of it. See how thick this is?
Now, so what we're looking at is, this is like a cereal bowl, basically.
It's a cereal bowl.
So it's probably like a palm full of dough, what looks like dough.
It's like a half cup.
Yeah.
This started off as 2 tablespoons.
Really?
Yeah, look at this. It's really puffed up. It's like a mushroom now, made a little dome. And here are the bubbles. This is only hours old. If I do that, look at the gluten
really
strands.
Gooey.
I'm pulling it up there. Texture.
So it's gooey. It's got visible bubbles. Like you're actually kind of breaking the bubbles when you run the chopstick through it.
And what I love is, look at the different flours. There's only two. There's, bread flour and whole wheat.
Cool.
And as I do this, you can see that, look what it's done to the gluten already. It's already formed strands just sitting there.
Yeah.
I didn't massage this or knead it or anything.
Because that's typically
doing.
How gluten is formed, is by kneading.
Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons that you knead a dough, is that you're forming these strands of gluten that will support the CO2 and give the bread
exactly.
structure.
Exactly. Yeah, that's been, the biggest problem with, though I've been involved with a lot of the gluten-free movement. It's something you have to accept is to trap the CO2 using a lot of binders. So a lot of gluten-free breads have an extra step, which is, I say just on the border of over-processed. Mm. Whereas with this is a pure food. I mean, it really is doing its own thing sitting there. And this is only, it's only hours old. And imagine,
so you made it this morning.
Yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
Awesome.
And so, by the end of the day, it's actually going to really fill up.
Can I smell it too?
Sure. It's sour.
Yeah. But it smells good. I mean, it smells yeasty.
It smells clean. It's not like pond scum.
No. It doesn't smell like yogurt or sour cream or anything.
Yeah, it's a very clean. You can smell the acid in it, and I think that's...
It doesn't smell like there's something wrong with it.
Yeah.
No. It smells like it's supposed to.
Yeah. So that's, knowing when it's ready is when it's created volume up to 3 times. Actually, with the starter I gave you in the jar, the tape mark is where it started off. If you notice, it's all...
Which is like 3/4 of an inch from the bottom, and now this is... That's a half pint glass, right?
Yeah.
It's almost to the top.
So, I mean, that's all CO2. And, on the way home, just burp it a little, whack it down.
Yeah, I'll make sure. It's going to be in my backpack for a little bit.
We
so.
Live in the age of...
be trekking around Manhattan for a while.
Yeah, we live in the age of Code Orange. You don't want to deal with that. So that's when you know it's ready. It's active. Like some people think it's supposed to look like soda, and I go, well, that's a misunderstanding of active. Active is, you started off with 2 tablespoons and you end up with like 8. That's active.
Yeah. And that's probably going to depend on the temperature of your environment, how much humidity. There's a lot of factors.
Oh yeah. What I've been doing is for home use. When I started, I actually let the cereal bowl sit in hot water, so it gets up to 85 degrees internally. So, as with any brewing, what's the internal temperature? Like with beer, you're constantly going, too high, it's going to kill yeast. No.
Yeah.
So, same thing with this is you want to maintain 86 to maybe 90 degrees internal temperature, Fahrenheit, so 30 degrees Celsius, onward. And that's about average. I mean, I always say these days I'm not so crazy about measuring it every time because it sucks the time out of you. I just say if I'm not burning myself, it's okay.
Yeah. And probably if you leave it at a slightly lower temperature, which it might take longer.
It takes longer. It will. I mean, refrigerated fermentation, which is the next step, that's 18 hours. And I'm always amazed that, let's say that when you see the volume double, at room temperature, I stick it in the fridge, and it will be eightfold by the time I pull it out after 8 hours. So in refrigerated temperatures of 42 degrees, 41, it's actively going without you. You know, you don't have to sit there going, please, please, please work. Please, please.
So at the point when your Lavvan is ready, then you, what's the next step?
Well, now you have your actual final dough formula. And you want to pay attention to, then this is very important for all baking, hydration. You know, whereas cooking is cooking, baking is science, and you basically have one shot to get this right.
Yeah. And, or you have to go back and start over. Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I know. But then you have to go, like, you know, time, quality, yes, and money. Pick two. So you start mixing your flours and your water. Now, hydration is a very important thing, especially with the sourdough, because that is the vehicle to have the yeast bloom, is a higher hydration than most breads. So I keep my hydration anywhere from, let's say, 60, you know, for a good firm loaf, to something like 70, 72 degree percent hydration for a ciabatta, which is like, you know, it's just like slinging wet dough on parchment paper.
Yeah.
But it makes the most beautiful interior, you know.
And you calculate your percentage of hydration.
Absolutely.
By weighing out your ingredients.
Yeah,
basically.
net weight. And that's the most important thing, is if you're going to do this, get a really good scale. Get down. Be a little spendy. Invest.
Yeah. And although they're not that expensive. I mean, you can get a pretty decent kitchen scale, like accurate kitchen scale, for not as much as it used to be.
Yeah. Although, do you know what I found recently? This is hilarious. A postal scale is cheaper than a lot of the commercial scales, and boy, are they accurate.
Yeah, I know. That's... Because I have this blade scale. I have like I think jewelers use it.
Oh yeah,
and same,
yeah.
You know, those kind. I mean, it was like $10 or something.
Wow,
on that, you know, popular internet site.
Yeah, yeah.
But
I mean, I think that there are two big investments to really think about. One is a very good accurate scale. Another one, everyone has a thermometer. If not, go and borrow one, go buy one. You can get one at Key Food for $8. It's not crazy.
Yeah.
Get a thermometer. It doesn't have to be outrageously crazy.
An oven thermometer. Yeah. Live in your oven.
Sorry. Get an oven thermometer, because that's what you really have to pay attention to as the baking process goes on. And now we're on the topic of baking vessels, and this is why I've been like Frankenstein with this.
This is a challenge for people that are baking at home.
It is, because by nature I'm cheap. And I went, I'm not paying $60 for some cloche that's going to crack in half. So I've been really playing around with, as you see right over here.
Yeah, this is awesome.
This is my solution that I found at Lowe's.
Nice.
It is a clay terracotta pot. And it'll bake a smaller loaf. I know that there are larger ones here, but you have to figure out, how big is this going to fit into your oven? Look at the size of that thing. I mean,
you've got a terracotta saucer.
Yeah.
And then a terracotta pot that's slightly smaller than the saucer that then is inverted and fits on top. And then talk about this thing.
All the pots have a hole in the bottom. So get a thick eye hook and a bolt with some washers so you seal the hole. And, you know, I've read some people saying they, you know, to seal the hole and make it airtight. It's never airtight, so don't go crazy. It's really about capturing the pressure. But what I love about the terracotta is it really crisps up the crust.
Yeah.
You know, if you like a really, really crunchy crust, I like this much better than cast iron. Like cast iron, well, first of all, you're gonna throw your back out putting it in the oven. It takes longer to heat. And I don't like burnt flour. And that's what I borrowed a friend's cast iron pot, and I went, yeah, it's okay. But also, here's the funny thing with cast iron I found out. I'm not going to mention any brand names, but do you know that the knobs have a lower range of temperature than the actual pot?
Like,
what? Yeah, so, you know, that's how they get you. You're going to buy a lot of knobs.
Oh, that makes sense.
An example is the enameled interior will take up to 425 recommended maximum, whereas the knob peters out at 375.
Oh, that's crazy. And you can also use a Dutch oven too.
Yes,
that's actually what I use at home. You don't. I mean, the loaves are not as pretty, right? I get a lot. Like when I used to do it, I get these round.
Yeah.
So how do you do your challah? Because it's beautiful.
Oh, that's just hand braided. I did not use a cloche on that, and I'll have to think about it because my braids are, as someone said, are a little fakakta. They're lumpy and they're uneven. That's just me. It's my fault. I take the responsibility.
It has personality.
You know, this is like the bubby of challah. You know, it's a funny, chubby little bread. But usually I bake in cloche for sourdough breads. Some of them I don't because I don't want them to dome as much. Well, a ciabatta, I'd never dome. I want that to have its own natural rise. But to get the classic boule or a batard, I highly recommend getting a cloche. And this is where the science comes in. Creating a batch of dough that fits just a half inch all the way around inside your cloche, you know, or if you're using, I love this porcelain crock pot here, you know, that works fine. I have to be a little careful about how I drop it in, mm-hmm. you know, because the whole point of this thing is creating oven spring. So just walking a brief overview of the process, you're going to create your dough. Your dough is going to ferment, and when it's ready, your vessel to create the classic sourdough loaf has to go into a hot container. You have to preheat that, your vessel.
Hmm.
I let these guys go for like an hour to really get the vessel at temperature, and what that is it guarantees what's called oven spring. Oven spring is the initial rise in your bread, and you have about 10 to 12 minutes. If not, then your bread never gets any bigger or higher. And, we've all seen different ways of controlling the rise, and one is slashing, you know, like the fancy little knife designs in them. You know, I'm not so good at that. I use scissors, and I'm happy with it.
Yeah.
Well, let me show you one of the scissor cuts.
Oh.
Oh, here we are. This is a scissor cut.
Oh, wow.
Oh, nice.
So it's very nice. It's really just like, you know, snip, 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 snip. And I like what it's
done.
And you
do that
here.
After you put it onto your vessel.
Actually, that is, I do this while it's in the vessel.
Okay.
There are different ways to do this.
Right when you put it in there.
Yeah, right when I put it in. It's not like half an hour before. It's right before you put it right in the vessel and bake. I prefer to put it in the vessel, either do a blade cut. Here's a classic blade cut, the double slash, you know, and then, you know, put it right into the oven. There are a few things people do before they do put in the oven. One is some people like doing a flour coat, because what that does is it creates a skin on the bread that makes it more amenable to rising and slashing. So, you know, stick it in the oven, it's covered.
Do you coat the whole entire thing with flour? Or just the bottom? Or
I do. Lately I've gone back to using just really good coarse rye flour.
Okay.
I started using rice flour, and I just thought it looked very dirty. You know, I say it's my skill level. It just always burnt and looked kind of smoky, you know, as opposed to, you know, when you go to the farmer's market and go like, oh, look at that artisanal bread. So I went back to rye flour because number one is I like the flavor.
Yeah.
You know, I think it adds another dimension to the bread that's on the surface. Like, I like the fact that the crust has a different flavor. And on my crusts, I really used, you know, a little bit of coarse salt and rye flour. And I like that it's a savory exterior, and then the inside is something tangy and complicated with a lot of nice texture.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
So one of the loaves that you made today, you said is for science and testing?
Oh, yeah. These are, well, that's the Korean chili and raisin.
Ooh.
You know, in the...